The following is a recording of Dr. Sheila Smith presenting Japan Rearmed, the Politics of Military Power, on March 6, 2020. The speaker is introduced by Ben Kennis.
Good morning and welcome. Glad to see a huge crowd here this morning. It's my privilege to introduce to you this morning Dr. Sheila Smith, Senior Fellow for Japan at the Council of Foreign Relations, an expert on Japanese politics and foreign policy. She's the author of Japan Rearmed, The Politics of Military Power, a copy of which you can obtain in the front after the presentation and the Q&A, and Dr. Smith will be available to sign. And she's written other books as well, published both in English and Japanese. Dr. Smith is a regular contributor to the CFR blog Asia Unbound and is also author of the CFR Interactive Guide, Constitutional Change in Japan. She is also a frequent contributor to major media outlets in the United States and in Asia. Dr. Smith joined CFR from the East-West Center in 2007, where she directed a multinational research team in cross-national study of the domestic politics of the U.S. military presence in Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. She was a visiting scholar at Keio University in Tokyo in 2007-2008, where she researched Japan's foreign policy towards China. Dr. Smith is chair of the U.S. Advisors of the U.S.-Japan Conference on Cultural and Educational Interchange, a binational advisory panel of government officials and private sector members. She teaches as an adjunct professor at the Asian Studies Department of Georgetown University and serves on the board of its Journal of Asian Affairs. Dr. Smith earned her MA and PhD from the Political Science Department at Columbia University. And with that said, Dr. Smith, welcome to the World Affairs Council of Hilton Head.
Thank you, John. Wow, I'm so excited. I give talk. Oh, that's a little loud, is it? Am I yelling at you? No, okay, it's fine, okay. If I start to yell at you, just wave from the back. This is a magnificent audience, I will say. I think this is the largest audience I've ever spoken to about my book, and so thank you very much for coming out. This is my first trip to South Carolina, and it is a beautiful, beautiful place. So I was out on your beach this morning taking an early stroll and loved it. So I thought what I'd do today is tell you not only about my book, but start off talking about why I wrote the book. As Ben pointed out, I did write a book in 2015 that looked at Japanese domestic politics and the rise of China. I was in Japan interviewing fishermen, consumer advocates, all kinds of people who were trying to contend with the new configuration of economic influence and power in Asia. And so for all of us who sit in Washington, of course, China's rise is the defining strategic variable and why we think about what it is we need to do, not only with our allies, but with other partners across the region. And one of the key pieces for me was the Japanese relationship with China was changing so fundamentally, and not just at the level of diplomacy or security, but also at the level of popular perceptions of China. And it was changing fundamentally, and it wasn't really clear to me how the Japanese people themselves were going to contend with this moment of geostrategic change. So that's the previous book. So lots of interviews, lots of field work. But the book that I just published last year, Japan Rearmed, is a book that I have been thinking about for decades. I wrote my PhD dissertation on the Japanese military and the very particular history of post-war Japan. This is an audience where I've met already many people who've had time living in Japan. And so I don't need to tell you this, but that Japan, after defeat in World War II, was occupied for 7 years by the United States. General Douglas MacArthur presided over that occupation, and one of the first things he did was to redraft the Japanese Constitution. That Constitution, there were three institutions that the United States wanted to change in their effort to demilitarize and democratize Japan. The first was the position of the Japanese emperor. The second was to eradicate or get rid of inherited political privilege or the aristocracy of Japan. But the third one is the most memorable one, and that is to change the way the Japanese military was allowed to operate. And in fact, initially, General MacArthur and his staff wanted to rid Japan of its military entirely. Today, however, 70-plus years beyond that era, Japan has one of the most formidable militaries in the region. It is its technological prowess, whether you're looking at its Air Force or its Navy. I'm not going to put its Army in there, and we can talk about that later if you'd like. But its technological prowess is second to none in the region. Its size, however, is increasingly smaller than its larger neighbor, China. It's physically and technologically far more powerful than South Korea. But I think we often think about Japan as a country that doesn't have a military, that is largely a pacifist society, that doesn't really believe in the importance of the military as an instrument of national power. And when I was in Japan doing my dissertation research at the end of the Cold War, or the beginning of this period we call the post-Cold War, I would have agreed with that, that the Japanese people would fundamentally never allow their military to go abroad. They would never really allow it to prepare for war. And they really didn't want it to have any role, not even in disaster relief activities, any role in Japanese civil society. But the last 30 years has changed a lot in Japan, and that's really what this book is about. It's not about Japan going from pacifism to militarism, and those are the two sort of poles that we often talk about Japan. Critics of Mr. Abe, for example, will argue quite profoundly, both inside the country and, of course, around the region, that Mr. Abe is taking Japan back towards a militaristic past, right? Government officials and self-defense leaders and others will say Japanese pacifism is getting in the way of Japan adapting to the geostrategic changes in the region, to the threats that are now emanating from China and North Korea. So pacifism and militarism, even within Japan, continue to be the polar opposites, the way in which the Japanese debate the changes that they're making in policy that allow their military to operate differently than in the past. So what I wanted, I live in D.C. I belong to the Council on Foreign Relations, which many of you may associate with being in New York, but I'm in their Washington, D.C. office, and I've been there now for 12 years. So I was there in 2010 when an inebriated Chinese fishing trawler captain had a tussle with two Japanese Coast Guard ships outside in the contiguous waters by the islands that the Japanese refer to as the Senkaku Islands. The Chinese and Taiwanese refer to them as Jiaoyu, or Jiaoyu Dao. But these are contested islands. The sovereignty is contested. And in 2010, that Chinese fishing trawler captain did something that no Chinese fisherman or any government agency of China, of course, had ever done before. He challenged the Japanese Coast Guard's ability to administer those waters, the legal right that they were exercising by trying to get him out of what they said were Japanese territorial waters. He rammed them both. At the time, the minister who was in charge of the Coast Guard said, we are going to charge him in court with getting in the way of the Coast Guard's ability to do their duty. Something like getting in the way of the police, right? The police are attempting to arrest you. It's a civil crime, not a law of the sea crime. But obstructing the Coast Guard in the performance of their duty, and they detained that captain. They eventually let him go. The Chinese and Japanese diplomats were deeply angry at each other, had no way of trying to temper the nationalist response or the more popular response to the incident. But it kind of calmed down just a little bit the year after, in 2011. The two governments signed an agreement that said, we need a risk aversion. We need some way of understanding how we won't repeat this in the future. And the Japanese government at the time decided that those little islands out in the middle of the East China Sea, they belonged to a private owner. They didn't belong to the state. They weren't public lands. They were held by a private owner. And they were increasingly worried that there were overtures by Taiwanese businessmen and others trying to purchase these islands from the private owner. So they bought them. What the Chinese said, they nationalized them. But the government purchased those islands. And then in 2012, the Chinese anger was quite severe. So what you had between 2010 and 2012 is an eruption of an issue that had long been in the back burner between China and Japan since they signed their peace treaty in 1978 that normalized diplomatic relations, but had never interfered with the basic relationship, which was largely premised on economic opportunity on both sides. So now you have a rising power. You have a challenge of Japanese sovereignty over these little uninhabited, by the way, uninhabited islands. But you also have a very strong Japanese desire to defend those islands from challenge by an increasingly militarily powerful China. So I was sitting in Washington, and our government said, oh my God, are the Japanese and Chinese going to war? This was a new way of thinking about what the American role might be in a crisis in Asia. Up until that point, the U.S.-Japan alliance, not like the Korean alliance that we have, was not really a war-fighting alliance. It was an alliance of deterrence. We would deter aggression against Japan. We have 50,000, give or take a few thousand, men and women in uniform now in Japan, some of whom serve on our only nuclear aircraft carrier that's deployed abroad. It's deployed in Yokosuka, Japan. We project our maritime power across what now we now refer to as the Indo-Pacific, not just the Pacific, but the Indo-Pacific, largely because we can base our Navy and to a certain degree our air forces on Japanese territory. So this has largely been a mutually comfortable arrangement between the United States and Japan, but never the integrated kind of war planning that you would see in our NATO alliance with our allies in Europe, or even our U.S. ROK alliance, where you would imagine potentially having a ground war on the Korean Peninsula. We didn't do contingency planning with the Japanese. We just said, we'd like to use your bases, and if we go to war in Asia, or for most of the time, during the Cold War and the aftermath, that war was going to be on the Korean Peninsula, or perhaps it was going to be in the tensions across the Taiwan Straits. It was not going to be on Japanese territory, because nobody imagined that Japan would be invaded, or that there would be a use of force incident directly against Japan. So Senkaku, even though it sounds kind of not so important to have coast guards and fishermen fighting in the East China Sea, all of a sudden in 2010 and then particularly in 2012, we began to see the dynamic could really quickly get out of hand. And Japanese military leaders, in addition to their government, prime minister in particular, we're very concerned about how the alliance might operate if something were to go wrong. Let's just say there was a miscalculation by a fisherman or by a Coast Guard ship. What happened then if the anger between the Japanese and Chinese was so sufficient? Could you see those two countries going to war? Well, Tokyo, the government in Tokyo certainly thought so. Our planners certainly thought so. It was a new scenario for the U.S. and Japan as they thought about how the alliance would function in today's Asia. Many people, very smart and savvy foreign policy thinkers, some of whom I'm sure you've had come visit you here, some are coming soon, would say, we don't want to get dragged into a war between Japan and China. So there was a very strong sort of messaging to Tokyo, calm down, we can't let this escalate. There was also very strong messaging in 2012 to Beijing. You don't want to miscalculate because this is an American ally. So lots of diplomatic signaling, on the one hand to reassure Japan that the alliance would work, but that they need to step back from the sovereignty dispute. And the other was to Beijing to say, don't misunderstand us. The U.S.-Japan alliance is important. Those islands are under the administrative control of Japan, and therefore Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty is operational. President Barack Obama went to Tokyo in 2014. He said so openly in Tokyo. The Senkaku Islands are under the protection of the United States under the terms of Article 5 of the Bilateral Security Treaty. President Trump, when he came into office, made a similar statement in February of 2017. So you're now looking at alliance and a military balance in Northeast Asia that has fundamental importance to us, right? We are there, we are on the front line, we have committed ourselves to respond, and we see the need for the U.S. and Japanese militaries to think through together how are we going to manage that kind of situation should it erupt. But the reason I'm telling you this long-winded story about the Senkaku Islands is to tell you that for the first time, a lot of planners in our government came to me and they said, what's going on? Why are they so worked up about the Senkaku Islands? How do we understand this? And so I had been doing the research for the previous book, and so I shared that research with them, and I spent a lot of time traveling between Tokyo and Washington and Beijing, actually, because the Japan-China relationship had shut down. And so a lot of American academics were still going to Beijing to talk about the tensions between Japan and China. And I was a Japan expert, so I was added to the U.S.-China mix to explain what the Japanese policy and public sentiment really was. So our alliance with Japan now, it looks at a whole host of issues, especially when it comes to military planning, that we haven't had to look at before. And I'll talk a little bit about those in just a second. So this book is largely something, these are topics and issues I've been thinking about since I did my PhD dissertation, and we won't confess how many years ago that was. So just a little bit ago. Because for me, the question here was, you have this Article 9 of the Constitution, which the Japanese largely interpret, the Japanese government and the parliament, their diet, interpret to allow for the right of self-defense. But they do not allow their military to maintain offensive strike capability. They do not, up until the end of the Cold War, they did not allow their military to be deployed abroad. But a lot of these interpretations have changed since the Cold War was over. And I thought our policymakers, particularly our military leaders, but also our civilian policymakers, needed to understand what was changing in the way the Japanese thought about their military, but also what was not changing. And so largely, this is a book that was designed to help our folks who really don't have a, they may have a long institutional relationship in managing the alliance, but they don't necessarily know how to read the politics internally in Japan that will affect the decision-making. Now, I normally give a slideshow when I give the book, but I recognize that's probably pretty boring for people who sit in the audience. So bear with me, though, because I'm going to read to you Article 9. It sounds a little bit pedantic because it's got a language that's all its own, but I think it's important to listen to the language if you'll allow me to do that. So Article 9 has two paragraphs. The first one comes from a treaty that was signed in 1928 in Europe called the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Anybody a diplomatic historian? Yeah? It must be, I'm sure, in this audience. We've got quite a few. The Kellogg-Briand Pact was, in fact, concluded by over, it was signed, ultimately, by over 270 countries. But it was designed to prevent the outbreak of war that the Europeans experienced in World War I. It was designed, and it was premised, and it was the precursor, if you will, to our collective security mechanism in the United Nations. The idea is very simple for all of us today, but at that point in time, it was pretty novel. The idea is we won't use force against each other. We will settle our disputes through diplomacy. That's the nuts and bolts of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. But up until the end of World War I, the sovereign right of states to use force to settle international disputes was never questioned. Right? So here you go. Aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation. And the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. So there's two things. One is obviously the echo of the Kellogg-Briand Pact language in international law. And again, you'll hear that when you look, if you look at the preamble of the United Nations Charter, you can see it there as well. The second is it puts the agency on the Japanese people. And that was the thing that Douglas MacArthur changed in the Constitution, or that when the Constitution was rewritten in 1947, it was no longer the emperor who represented Japanese sovereignty. It was the Japanese people. Popular sovereignty is the crux of the document that now underpins Japanese democracy, and Article 9 includes that piece. Now, the second paragraph gets a little murky, and this is where you have huge people, you have lots of debate over this, but I'm going to tell you why it sounds so legalistic. This is the paragraph that the Japanese parliament, that Japanese elected officials who approved the occupation draft in 1946 and 1947, this is the language that they tweaked. In order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, sounds like a nice piece of bureaucratic language, right? Any bureaucrats in the room? Sorry. Bureaucrats are very proud of this kind of language, but it's important, right? Land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized. So the secret code in there that the Japanese elected officials put into that second paragraph was in order to accomplish the preceding paragraph. We won't have military power, but we will allow ourselves to have military power to defend ourselves. So that is the fundamental post-war interpretation of Japan's right of self-defense. Its military, formed in 1954, the Self-Defense Force, carries that principle in its name. It's not called a defensive force. It's not called a military. The characters for military, the Chinese characters, are not used anywhere in Japanese military planning or in any public government statements. Right? It's all about defense, all about self-defense. So Article 9 is a document that continues to be interpreted in Japan, and I'll talk to you towards the end of this about how it was interpreted. So peace came to Japan in 1952. We're not going to go year by year. I promise you, I'm not going to take you through every year of Japanese post-war history. But it's important to remember that there was a seven-year occupation and the San Francisco Peace Treaty was concluded in 1952. The man that negotiated for the Japanese was Prime Minister Yoshida Shigeru, a former diplomat in the pre-war period. He had been elected in the first 1946 election. He presided over much of the occupation, and he presided largely over the configuration of Japan's post-war strategy and diplomacy. Yoshida doctrine is a word you'll hear a lot if you speak to Japanese academics or Japanese policymakers or even the Japanese public about Japan's strategy. But that doctrine is twofold. One, limited armament, limited military capability, and two, reliance on the United States for deterrence and defense. And in 1952, accompanying that document that returned Japanese sovereignty to Japan was a bilateral basing agreement that allowed the United States to keep military forces on Japanese territory. It was not a mutual defense pact. It was a basing agreement. And at the end of the occupation, there were 360,000 U.S. servicemen, largely men, not a lot of women, but largely men, 360,000 U.S. personnel still stationed in Japan after the occupation ended. Now, today, we have a far lower number of Americans there, but we have a far more significant military capability, American military capability, in the region based in Japan, as I said earlier. What I think surprises a lot of people, given this history, given the unique constitution, right, is that Japan still invests considerable amounts of money in its military power. And so I recognize that I think Maureen gave you some questions at the beginning before I started speaking. And one of those was, how important is the Japanese military if you compare it to other countries? And I think she got a different statistic than I did, but her source said it was the fifth most important military in the world. It's not how we think about Japan, right? We think, oh, Japan's not armed. Japan doesn't have a military. Wrong. If you think about the Japanese, even if you think about, oh, the Japanese people are pacifist, they don't think military power matters, also wrong. So there's an institution in Stockholm called SIPRI, and any of you who want to look up military spending, it's the place you go, because they have all the economists who dig out all the details on budgets and compare and contrast. But in 2017, Japan basically tied the United Kingdom for seventh place in the world. So Japan invests as much in military power as our NATO allies, the United Kingdom, Japan, and Germany are about the same number. In 2017, that was somewhere around $47 billion. Last year's Japanese defense budget was somewhere in the order of $52 billion. So nothing to sneeze at. I'm sure Japan is probably number six or number seven today, just in terms of investment. It matters, though, that its next-door neighbor, China, is number two, and China is investing, if we can get the numbers, confident numbers, $228 billion. So Japan is nowhere near the level of investments that you see the Chinese making. Anybody want to take a guess about us? Three times the amount the Chinese are investing, and I'm not really sure that captures our new military budget. So we are still the dominant investor in military power in the world, but China's number two, number three is Saudi Arabia, number four is Russia, number five is India. And then comes our allies right behind that. So you have a country that believes it needs military power, restrains the way that military power is going to be used and organized, but is increasingly seeing the military as an instrument of statecraft as being fundamentally important. So here this is the book, and I will not go into all the details of the book, because then why would you buy it? I'm hoping maybe somebody here would like to invest in my book. My son's in college, so I hope you do. but seriously, there's four ways that I break out the changes that I think are important to understand about the way in which Japanese thinking, and I'm talking about governments as well as public, and each of the chapters about these different dimensions have different pieces of that puzzle for you. But there are four ways. One, the Japanese do now send their military abroad. They did it partly as a result of pressure from the United States. In the first Gulf War, 1990-91, we wanted to shift away from seeing our alliances as solely being about their defenses, and we wanted to build more coalitions for global security challenges. The first Gulf War was our first effort at coalition building. Our NATO allies went. Japan was asked to go. Lots of Japanese of that era remember very conspicuously the U.S. ambassador in Tokyo demanding meetings with the prime minister and saying, Japan, you need to go. You need to send your forces, right? They didn't at that time. Instead, they decided that they would embrace a role for their military in peacekeeping operations, United Nations peacekeeping operations. And there were two reasons for that. One is the preamble of the Japanese Constitution references the language in the United Nations document itself. The Japanese public feel very strongly about the United Nations and support Japan's role in support of the United Nations, right? So that's one piece. The second was Cambodia. The person who was just taking up the head role of the UN Transitional Authority in Cambodia, right? There'd been a long, protracted civil war in that country. That person was Mr. Akashi, who was a Japanese diplomat, a Japanese UN official. So there were several reasons why that was a good idea. The PKO legislation would be easier to pass, and the Japanese military, who got sent as engineering troops largely, there were some police monitors of ceasefires and election activities. Those people would be able to go in a fairly comfortable environment because the leader of that mission was Japanese and understood the politics and the difficult politics of sending the self-defense forces there. So 1991 is when the PKO mission first takes root in Japan and the self-defense forces go abroad. Or so you might think. There are other actual moments, and several of you have told me that you've been in the Navy, the U.S. Navy in Korea. There were other moments when the Japanese military went abroad. It just wasn't widely known. And the service that went abroad was the Japanese Navy. And it was specifically their minesweepers. Japanese minesweepers of the Imperial Navy, not the self-defense forces, right? The war navy cleared the mines for the Incheon landing. They were one of many sets of minesweeping ships that were there doing the minesweeping in the Korean War. But the second place they went is in the Iran-Iraq War in 1986, way before the Cold War ended, before this debate about coalitions. Japanese minesweepers actually went to sweep mines in the Persian Gulf, as did a number of our other allies. And I write about that in detail in the book, largely because it's a great story. If you'll let me share the fun parts of the story are the minesweepers in 1980 were still wooden ships. They didn't have sonar. They didn't have any of the sonar array that our much more sophisticated ships had, or our German or British. They went down in the old-fashioned scuba gear, you know, with the helmet. Sharks. There's sharks in the Persian Gulf. So I read there was a lot of diaries of the people who were on that mission. And it was a quiet mission. The Japanese public didn't have much knowledge of it, and the people who did didn't like it. But it was done after the Iran-Iraq War was over. And the minesweepers themselves put in at port in Iran because Japan and Iran had a very good relationship. So it's a little tidbit about Japanese minesweeping activity that not many people are aware of. But the real change was this peacekeeping operations. The second change, of course, came after 9/11, when the United States really did want its allies to contribute and support in far more difficult circumstances. And here the Japanese were really a little bit torn. They wanted to participate in the coalition because they'd had a really bad experience in 1991. They got criticized very heavily in the Western media for being a checkbook power, right? For those of you, I heard a yeah. There's some yes, some people remember that. And Japanese in the Gulf, remember, or Japan depends on its on the Gulf for its own oil and resources. So lots of people in the Gulf felt that censure by the Western press pretty strongly. But after 9/11, then Japanese diplomats were really intent on not having the same experience, not being the ally that didn't show up, especially when it was the American homeland that was hit. So after 9/11, it took a lot of negotiation, and again, a lot of this is in the book, but the Japanese Self-Defense Force, the ground Self-Defense Force this time, did go to Iraq for reconstruction activities. It went to a fairly safe zone, if you could have a safe zone in Iraq at that point in time. And the interesting thing for me about that was the gentleman who went over there, the colonel, Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force colonel, who went over to say, you know, where are we going to go, how are we going to liaise with others in the region, et cetera, was a very dashing colonel. He's now a Diet member, he's a parliamentarian, he's a politician now, with a mustache. And so he was called the mustachioed Colonel Sato in the Japanese media. But everybody watched him on TV. This was not a quiet deployment. This was not people trying, the government trying to keep everything out of the eyes of the public. This was national television. I was in Japan at the time, and it was everybody was mesmerized by Colonel Sato with the mustache. His nickname is Higeno Sato-san. But there he was, speaking English fluently, hanging out with Iraqi officials, local community leaders, looking like Japan's global envoy to Iraq. And I'm not saying that everybody in Japan supported the mission. I'm not saying that at all. But this was a whole different moment. And it's largely, he was telegenic, he was effective, but also the PKO missions now had some time for the Japanese public to accept and to get used to. And so even going to Iraq after the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, even something that was so problematic politically in Japan, was largely seen as a humanitarian mission, and the Self-Defense Force performance of that was largely accepted by the Japanese public. Now, today, I went back and looked at, and I do this in the book, but I went back and looked at how many Self-Defense Force personnel. There's about 120,000 men and women in uniform in Japan, the entire Army, Navy, and ground Self-Defense Forces, right? How many people have international experience? Less than 10%. So even though I'm saying this was a big change for Japan, it is not the way most of the Japanese military experience their duty, right? So the PKO is by far the largest number of people, at about 12,000 who've participated up to date, about 30-plus PKO missions all around the world. Disaster and humanitarian aid now is another thing that the Japanese military do quite freely in the Philippines, other parts of Asia. About 3,000 or 4,000 Self-Defense Force personnel have had that experience abroad. They are an active and a longstanding member of our anti-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden. So about 1,300 or 1,400 Navy personnel, Maritime Self-Defense Force personnel, have participated in the anti-piracy operations. And after after 9/11, operations that were associated with the U.S. response to 9/11, gave about 2,000 Self-Defense Force personnel the opportunity to go to the region in different capacities. So the idea that Japan's military can wear the uniform and go overseas, I think, was long seen by the Japanese public as anathema to the post-war period, right? Because the pre-war history was not a positive one, right? But today, the Japanese work in coalition with us, with the United Nations, with other partners, the Indians, the Philippines, Vietnam. You'll see Japanese military, Navy, Maritime Self-Defense Force ships do annual Indo-Pacific tours around the region, very different than 10 or 20 years ago. So it's a very different piece of Japan's engagement, not only with the world, but also with its neighbors. The most critical place, and I'm going to try to abbreviate a bit here so we can get to Q&A, but I think the part, though, that is the heart and soul of the fundamental changes in Japan that matter since the end of the Cold War is the way in which the Japanese now mobilize their military to deal with the threat environment in Northeast Asia. Until 2004, Japan didn't have a law that allowed for contingency planning, what we would assume to be contingency planning. And by that I mean not just going out and exercising and practicing, right, military capabilities and operations, but the integration of civilian and military authorities in the time of war or crisis. There was nothing on the books. Nobody wanted it on the books, except the Ministry of Defense, right? And one of a Japanese general in the 1970s said, "You're telling us to defend the country, but you're not giving us the legal authority to do it. So if we are attacked," this is 78, this was General Kurisu, who was big scandal. He said, if Japan is attacked, the parliament hasn't given us the authority to respond. So we may just have to take extra legal matters. Well, you can imagine that language, right? Imagine if our military started talking about taking extra legal matters, right? We were like, whoa, democracies don't do that. He summarily was fired by the prime minister, but he got full honors by all of his commanders, the self-defense force, as he left the Ministry of Defense, the defense agency grounds, because he said out loud what most commanders of the Japanese military knew, and that is they were expected to defend Japan, but the government, the legislature, had not passed the law that would stipulate the transfer of authority in an emergency between civilians and military leaders. That didn't happen until 2004. So entire history of post-war Japan, you basically saw civil control over the state, jealously guarded by civilians, as it should be, as it should be, but no active planning for the what ifs. What if we're invaded? What if we have to order our military to act? Then how do we share authorities in that time of emergency? So the Japanese word for this law is yujiho, which means an emergency law, right? It's not even an operational military term. But that law, the whole array of sharing of civil and military authority in the time of crisis, that legal, there were many, many laws associated with that package that went through the Diet in 2004. And then an addendum, a separate law in 2005, passed the Diet that was very specific to one mission, and that was ballistic missile defenses. Why? Because ballistic missile defenses were now Japan's primary concern, because the North Koreans had capabilities, but so did the Chinese and many others. And Japan doesn't have ballistic missile capability, right? So you can't deter ballistic missile strikes, but you began to see the Japanese invest deeply in ballistic missile defense technologies. And those technologies decisions need to be fast, right? If there's an incoming missile, you can't wait for the prime minister to call up the minister of defense, to call up the commander and say, "I think it's okay if you shoot," right? You're talking about seconds, minutes, seconds, from detection to actual response. So the ballistic missile defense law for me is interesting because it is the first time you get the actual devolution of authority. If you are in a moment of missile threat, if the prime minister and then the minister of defense says, "You have my permission to issue," you have what's called a missile destruction order, then the uniformed commander has full discretion over the response. Now, for anybody, I'm sure lots of you have served in the United States military, that's kind of a no-brainer. If you want your military to act, then you give it permission to act, right? I don't think we would have this debate in such a considerable way. But for Japan, of course, the historical legacy of the pre-war period ran very deep for generations. But it began to change the way the Japanese wanted their military to be ready and prepared to defend the country, and that was in the 2000s, right? So mobilizing the military, making sure they're ready, thinking about specific missions like ballistic missile defense, or the second mission, which I think is equally important, which is island defenses, and that's a generic term used by the Ministry of Defense to include a whole array of things, not just the Senkaku Islands, the little tiny islands in the East China Sea. Japan is an archipelagic state. All of those are island defenses, right? So that is the maritime and air combination of how do we defend our territory, not on our territory, but offshore. And last year, you saw for the first time the Japanese Ministry of Defense announced that it was going to invest in standoff strike capability, which means that the Navy and the Air Force will fight offshore Japanese territory any military that comes close to territorial waters or airspace or land of Japan. So let me ask you to look at your handout. You should, I think Maureen and others were giving us handouts, so I wouldn't bore you with lots of slides. But this one I couldn't get around. It's important because it shows you how the Japanese Ministry of Defense perceives the threat environment. I'm going to take a quick sip. So this gets updated every year in the Ministry of Defense of Japan white paper. It's their annual defense paper. Kind of sliding. So you can go online. It's in English. You can see it every year. You can see the updates. And on these updates, the first one is the maritime and air activities of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. Now, some of you are looking at this going, it's upside down. It is not upside down. I wanted you to see it for precisely this reason. So the header, right, which says Chinese activities in seas and airspace around Japan, that's at the top, right? If you kind of put it flat in front of you, what you're doing here is you're looking out at Japan from the Chinese mainland. Is that easier maybe than your handout? If I had a pointer, I could do that, but I can't because it's very high. So you're looking out from continental Asia. You're looking out from China, in other words. And you'll see there are two red squares. Those are major Chinese fleets. Okay. You're looking at the Korean Peninsula projecting out there, sort of in the middle of the map. It has a box of text over it, but that's Korea, south and north. But this is the way the Japanese see the military pressures on their maritime and airspace. Not the way we normally look at our map, but looking at how the Chinese and, if you're looking up here on this part of your map, the Russians, because the Russians are still over here to the north of Japan, and they're still quite active in Air Force testing of Japanese defenses, right? So every year you get to see exactly what forces the Chinese are sending in and around Japanese airspace and waters. And every year it gets busier. Every year you get more boxes. Every year you get more qualitatively impressive Chinese military capability. In other words, it's not just one airplane or two airplanes. Now you're getting joint patrols between Russian and Chinese forces, right? So there's an awful lot of pressure on Japan's Air Force to scramble not only in the north, but to scramble all the way down around the Korean Peninsula and down into the south, southern part in the East China Sea. You have a new moment where the Japanese now are trying to figure out how to reorient their military to the southwestern region of the country. So that would be down here where the yellow and red, lots of arrows coming and going through the straits of those islands. Those are the Ryukyu Islands, or Okinawa, as you may know of them. Lots of Chinese activities going in and out. Not illegal, not a problem, because those are international waters, those straits. But certainly an awful lot of military capability now in and around islands that the Japanese feel are spread out and not easily defended. So the new southwestern strategy by the Self-Defense Force is twofold. It is to reorient the military towards the southwest, which is where they feel the Chinese pressure is going to come most acutely. Second, they are coordinating naval and air capabilities. They are beginning to do much more joint exercising and operations and planning among the different services, which is not the historical experience of many Japanese military officers. But today, the activities of the Chinese and the increasing capabilities of the Chinese are really pushing the Japanese self-defense forces to be on alert most of the time. The Air Self-Defense Force is on readiness, wartime readiness, defensive readiness 24/7. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. Now they are, sometimes their scrambles are over 1,000 times per year in the number of scrambles that are largely dedicated towards just the Chinese. That doesn't include the Russians. So the Russians are still pretty active up in the north, and now the Chinese and the Russians are doing not only air exercises together, but also maritime exercises together. We can talk more about that if you'd like. So that's the threat environment as the Japanese perceive it, coming largely from China, but China and Russia on continental Asia. The flip over, and I'll show you what happened in 2017. Some of you are familiar with this already. We all kind of watched it from over here in the United States. It was in the headlines, right? And that was when Kim Jong-un was testing all those missiles. And there was a little bit of the Trump administration had to deal with the North Korean threat and the missile testing, the fire and fury moment in our policymaking. But what I wanted to do there is just look at the dates. So they're chronologically in order from February, right, all the way down to late November of 2017. And you can see that every one of those tests, be they short range, medium range, or even the ICBM tests, the two important ICBM tests that many of our experts were watching, they were all in the direction of Japan. They either overflew Japanese territory, they landed in Japan's EEZ, and the last two ICBM tests went over Japanese airspace in Hokkaido. Right? So that's the second kind of threat that the Japanese feel most acutely. Again, as I said earlier, Japan does not have its own ballistic missiles, so it's not as if you've got a deterrent where the Japanese can threaten a strike if the North Koreans decide that they want to test Japanese defenses. But there's two things here that operators will notice from this and from that 1 year. The first is Japan is a bit vulnerable, but it also sits offshore of the Korean Peninsula, right? So if the North Koreans are going to shoot anything at Guam, for example, or worse than that, all the way over on our west coast, they would be overflying Japanese airspace. The second thing, though, is what the Koreans were trying to say to Japan is they now have mobile launchers, undetectable, multiple missile launches at the same time, and that will easily overcome, in a moment of war, that would easily overcome ballistic missile defenses. It's very hard to shoot at multiple targets, to detect, to follow the trajectory, and then to defend against multiple incoming missiles. So the messaging was pretty clear there, and I think the messaging for the Japanese was also pretty conspicuous. Prime Minister Abe at the time also pointed out by the end of this year that there's another dimension to this, and that is, at least in terms of chemical weapons, the North Koreans have a significant arsenal. So you wouldn't have to just associate fissile material and a nuclear armed missile. You could imagine considerable damage to Japanese civilian centers from other kinds of weapons of mass destruction. So that in turn prompted a conversation we can talk about during the Q&A if you're interested, but a conversation among senior politicians and policymakers, including our policymakers, about is it now time for Japan, in fact, to invest in a conventional strike capability, not a nuclear capability, but in the kinds of missiles that all of Japan's neighbors possess. And the political rationale for this is if Japan has a capability of retaliating, in other words, not just depending on ballistic missile defenses, right? If it can retaliate, then maybe the deterrent will be stronger. Maybe North Korea won't test Japan, or China won't test Japan sufficiently. So that's a political decision that's not yet made, but it's certainly a conversation that our policymakers and Japanese policymakers have been having on and off now for some time. Now, at the end of the day, I'm going to conclude so we can actually have a Q&A, because I probably have talked more than you need me to talk. There's two other chapters of the book, and we can follow this in Q&A if you're interested. One is the Constitution itself. Prime Minister Abe reinterpreted Article 9 in 2014. And by that, what I mean by reinterpreted is the official government interpretation of Article 9 shifted on one aspect of how the government has long read the limits on its military. And this is getting very bureaucratic again, but it is the right of collective self-defense. And that's the language that the Japanese use. The right of collective self-defense is to allow the use of force by the self-defense forces to protect another country or another military. Most obviously, it would be ours. So the self-defense forces have never been able to shoot down any aircraft, for example, that might threaten our aircraft, or any ship that might threaten our ship, because the Japanese government has consistently said that is outside of the interpretation, our interpretation, of the right of self-defense. Deeply difficult issue inside Japanese politics. But in 2014, Prime Minister Abe said, the time has come for us and our military to be able to operate alongside other militaries, and that means we must be able to use force to defend those militaries if we are acting in concert with them. The caveat here, of course, is that if it is necessary for Japan's security. It is not an open-ended, we're going to send forces around the world and they can shoot whenever they're operating around the world. That's not true. It has to be officially interpreted by the cabinet to be necessary for the security of Japan, right? But in important things that have happened since that, the laws passed in 2015 that implemented that cabinet decision, huge demonstrations, huge reinvigoration of a kind of anti-Abe, but also an anti-war movement, small scale, nothing like the early post-war years, but still very, very revealing a very deep sensitivity on the part of the Japanese people about how far Mr. Abe was taking Japan and its use of force. For those of you interested in how that actually turned out in operations with the U.S. military, it now allows the U.S. military, the Self-Defense Force to do what our military calls asset protection, which is ships largely on the sea. In our carrier task forces now, Japanese destroyers can provide asset protection to our military assets in the Indo-Pacific. There are other ways in which it's been interpreted also. We can talk more about that. So what's changing is the long and very strict controls on the military itself, but also in the way that the Japanese government imagines it might use military force, even with us. They're relaxing, not in a revolutionary kind of way, but they're slowly relaxing to cope with the threat environment that Japan currently faces in Northeast Asia. At the end of the book, because I live in Washington, and because I'm at the Council on Foreign Relations, I was asked to take a look ahead about where Japan might be headed. And what I wanted to point out again, because this book was really dedicated to an American audience, and especially our American policymakers, is the threat environment and the intense pressure now on Japanese defenses hasn't changed the Yoshida Doctrine. It hasn't changed the interpretation of Article 9 with the one exception of that collective self-defense. Right? It hasn't changed the reliance on the United States to deter aggression against Japan. So the basic formula, the strategic formula that Japan began the post-war period with, moved through the Cold War and then 30 years beyond to a very different strategic situation in Asia. Fundamentally, Japan remains committed to limiting its military capability to the role of defense. The one variable I would argue that would change that would be us. If we are no longer willing to provide strategic protection, which is what we do under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, of our treaty with ROK, of our treaty with Japan, if we decide that we would no longer like to play that role, then Japan's policies will have to change. And they could change in multiple directions. I just wrote a paper about that separately, but we could discuss it if you'd like. Lots of people jump to the nuclear option. I don't think that's obvious for Japan. It could be a combination of China under the right diplomatic package from Beijing. It could be in greater independent capability, including perhaps military capability. It could be a more collective approach with the other major powers of the Indo-Pacific. But if our willingness to provide that strategic protection for Japan, including a nuclear umbrella, if that goes away, then Japan will have to change the way it has organized itself militarily and the way it interacts with other actors in the region. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Should I keep this on? People need to go. Oh, I see, okay. Am I still on? I'm still on. I think